This is Rumblestrip, good conversation that takes its time.
What was your little league team? What were you on?
Red Sox.
Oh.
Yeah.
I was on the Tigers. I think we were better than you. Were we better than you?
Yeah, I'm sure.
Do you remember sewer balls?
Oh, yeah. I do.
There was this big kind of open sewage patch.
Yeah, it was down near where the old ice rink was. Yeah.
So the balls would go, you know, you'd hit a foul and it would go into the leech field and you'd have to go get it out with
paper scissors. Who's going to go?
You'd have to pick it out with two fingers.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I hadn't even thought about that for years till you mentioned it. What a riot.
That's J.P. Sinclair. We went to Charlotte Central School together from kindergarten through eighth grade, like 10 million years ago. J.P. was a year ahead of me. His dad was a cop. And when you go to a school as small as ours, for as long as we did, you remember each other, or you remember the essential parts of each other. What I remember about J.P. is just that he was decent. He was just a decent kid. He used to skip recess and help the lunch ladies clean up the cafeteria, stuff like that. After school and after college, J.P. joined the Vermont State Police like his father, and over a 31-year career, he was at the center of over 500 death investigations and 101 homicides. He served as the state police chief criminal investigator, and he led the Vermont State Police Bureau of Criminal Investigations. He was also instrumental in forming a major crime unit in the state of Vermont to handle the state's most egregious cases. And every now and then I would read about him in the news, this kid I went to school with, now one of the most important people in law enforcement in the state. JP retired in 2018, and when I heard he was retiring, I asked if he would let me interview him. JP does not really like to be interviewed, but since we played Little League together, he said yes. This is part one of my conversation with J.P. Sinclair. Next week, you'll hear part two. Here's J.P. Sinclair.
I did about 5.5 years as a road trooper, and then I had an opportunity to lateral transfer into a detective trooper position in the Criminal Investigation Bureau. And once I got into that, I loved it.
So what was it about criminal investigation when you started doing that? What clicked?
For me, it was just, when I got into criminal investigations, they were just deeper, broader, more in depth, and they were challenging. They were really challenging to me that, you know, I would get presented a case, an incident, something that's happened, and it was up to me to use experience, whatever, ingenuity, just figure it out, you know, come to a conclusion. And, you know, and the challenge of taking a criminal case that the person that did it, the bad guy or woman, they have every advantage to break every rule to try and get away from you. But you have this very strict set of parameters. You have to stay within the legal system to prove your case and then present it to a prosecutor and then to the courts, ultimately a jury, a judge. It was just very rewarding to me that, especially with some of these victims of crime, that, you know, they're coming to you in their darkest moment. They're hurt, they're pissed off, they've just had their world rocked and turned upside down because of somebody else's actions. And they put all their faith and trust in you that, you know, you've got the ability and the drive to bring them some sense of justice out of the whole system.
It's so funny to hear you say that because having worked for the defense only, you know, as a private investigator, my thought was always that the prosecution and that the law enforcement had all the goodies, had all the resources, and that the defense was always scrappy and kind of coming up from behind.
Yeah. Yeah. I suppose it's always what side of the fence you're on, which, you know, I'll fully admit when I first started in police work, I really had a hard time my first couple of years adjusting to the concept of like the plea bargaining system. And I certainly grew to appreciate why it's there and its functions in the system. But I can remember working really hard on, we had a series of burglaries to businesses spanning from St. Johnsbury up to Lennonville. There's like five different places got hit. There was a crew of three guys that did it. And I worked so hard on that case. It took me 6 months, but I got it. I put it all together. I had more than enough. And I made the arrests, and I put together this massive case volume to bring up to the prosecutor for, you know, multiple counts of burglary, unlawful mischief, all the crimes that were were associated with these investigations. And I can remember getting my slip back from the state attorney's office where, you know, they all took part in it. So they each got charged with, you know, five B&Es.
What is B&E?
Burglaries, breaking and entering. You know, so you, like I get a slip back on one guy that says, I know he broke into five places. And I know he committed these other crimes associated with the burglary. But his slip says he pled to two burglaries. You know, three others were amended down to a trespass. And then these other crimes were just dropped. You know, and I'm sitting there looking at it thinking, what in the world? You know, this person committed all these crimes. And I worked for 6 months to put all this together. And now my case, all that hard work, you know, the people that had their lives disrupted and their businesses burglarized had to come in the morning and clean up glass. And I'm thinking, how are they not held responsible for this? It really got under my skin in the beginning. But over time, I grew to appreciate it, to understand there's another side to this. The people that broke into this place, you know, maybe they're not just crumb buckets. There was a substance abuse problem. There was poverty. There was, you know, some reasons behind a desperation to do this. I have seen enough times in my career that I think there's just true blue evil out there. But I think that's a very small, small segment. And so I guess over time I've grown to appreciate and just put trust in the prosecutors that, in the defense, that, you know, they're going to sit down and go, okay, here's a reasonable resolution to this case. Might just go into trial.
What did class have to do with school? What do you remember about different kids and whether or not class played a role in our lives in school?
Well, you know, I think back now, and I guess one of the fondest memories I have of us growing up in Charlotte and going to CCS was that, you know, I can remember, you know, going to school with like Alfred. He was a friend of mine. You know, and now as an adult, you realize, you know, he came to school in the dead of winter with worn out sneakers with holes in them. And back then, you don't think twice about it because, you know, who cares? Let's go out on the playground and have fun. Now you realize, you know, socioeconomic barriers and things that he was dealing with in his family or, you know, other kids that we went to school with. I don't ever remember it being, you know, something that any kid was ashamed of or that any other kid put somebody down for. You know what I mean? I mean, we went to school with people that lived in probably million-dollar homes but didn't come to school and act like it. I just don't remember people being mean to one another. I mean, certainly disagreements or arguments or even I'll meet you back in the swing, you know, out of the playground, you know, and, you know, the playground monitor's not looking and you settled some things. But, you know, everybody got along good.
When you're doing initial interviews with the accused, can you talk about your strategy and how you interface with people? What was your style?
And one of the valuable things I learned early on, you know, even in the smaller investigations, misdemeanor investigations, through to a homicide, it doesn't matter. You need to learn everything you can possibly learn about this person before you sit down with them. You need to know about their life history. You need to know about their criminal history. You need to know everything you can possibly learn from other ancillary witnesses and really understand who it is that you're going to talk to. I never tried to make myself, I guess, you know, this imposing person or this, you know, just always remember in the back of your head, you're just talking to another person and they bring with them life experiences, baggage, you know, and maybe, you know, as they grew up, some cop came through the door and beat up their old man, you know, or, you know, you never know. If I learned something about them, I learned they had this horrible abusive history as a kid. They had a father who used to kick the crap out of them. But now I'm investigating them for assaulting somebody else. Let them know you understand their life history. You understand, you even appreciate, but you're here to do a job and this isn't going to go away. But let me hear from you your whole story and this whole thing because they're going to hold you accountable.
You just talked about taking into account the fact that everybody arrives to where they are for reasons, right? Mm-hmm. And everybody arrives to where they arrive to by virtue of a life lived. And you have to understand that when you walk in the room. Yeah. But in a way, you're there to get information. And so it's both honest and it's also manipulative. So how do you deal with that?
Yeah, and you know, whenever I sat down with people, I just tried to impart to them, listen, no matter if you talk to me or not, no matter if you tell me the truth or lie to me or not, the investigation's still rolling forward. There's nothing you can do to go backwards in time to change what you did. That's set in time, and the evidence is set in time. Physical, testimonial, witness, whatever. You know, it's nothing wrong with me sitting down with an accused and telling them, look, this is how this is going to work. I'm going to continue the investigation. I am trying to be fair. It's my responsibility to talk to you. Prosecution, defense, everybody's going to want to know that I did a complete investigation, which includes coming to talk to you. You can tell me to pound sand. You can tell me to get the hell out of here. That's fine. I'll document that. I'll move on. It doesn't mean everything stops. So as this continues down the line, that's what's documented. But even some of the people that, you know, I've arrested over years and put in jail, and I still see in the community. I mean, I live here. I'm sure there's been times that, you know, people have looked at me cross-eyed in a restaurant or something like that, and, you know, but I've never had an ugly confrontation or, you know, anything like that. And there's actually been guys that I've dealt with, you know, that I've seen that, you know, I literally rolled around in the dirt with, but, you know, that I can see at a gas station and walk up and shoot the breeze with now. It's like Dwayne Mich, he was a logger up here, and he could be a rough guy. When he was drinking, he could be pretty violent. And I was a young trooper, and there used to be a place called the Pizza Keg over in Lindenville. You know, when we're working, I worked a lot of nights. A lot of times it was just me and one other person. We're covering all of Caledonia and half of Essex County. So, wow. You know, for all practical purposes, there's not a lot of backup. You know, sometimes you're far apart. And a call came in one night at the Pizza Keg that Dwayne was there. He was drunk and he was fighting with some guys in the bar. So I went there. My backup was, you know, 30 minutes away trying to get to me. So I pulled in, I walked in, and there was like three guys, you know, laid out on the floor picking themselves up, and Dwayne sitting at the bar. And he had just like mopped the floor with these three guys. I mean, he was a rugged guy. And so I walked up to the bar, and I had seen Dwayne around. And, you know, when he wasn't drinking, you know, he was actually kind of a quiet guy. I would see him at a gas station or whatever and talk with him. And so I walked up to the bar and I sat down next to him and I said, Dwayne, kind of a rough night, huh? And he had his beer and, you know, he turned around. And he said, well, for them it was. And I said, well, Dwayne, it's, you know, the staff doesn't want you here. And we got two plans here tonight. And he turned and looked at me. And of course, I'm only 5'7". I'm not a big guy. And, you know, Dwayne was a big boy. And he said, well, what's that? I said, well, plan A is, you know, you and I can walk out together and jump in the cruiser. I'll take you home. You know, I've already talked to these guys. They don't want to press charges. They're not going to tell me what's happening. And so I can just, you know, I'll drive you home, get a ride down tomorrow, pick up your truck, go to work in the woods. And, you know, that's it. And he said, well, what's plan B? And I said, well, plan B is you and I start rolling around on the ground. And then there's going to be, you know, another guy and a couple more guys dressed just like me. They're going to show up eventually. And you're going to jail. So, and then we're going to tow your truck. And then tomorrow you're going to have to pay fines, get out of jail, get a ride, get your tow truck out of impound. And it's going to be a big pain in the butt. And so he looked at me, he's finished off his beer, put it down and says, let's go to plan A. And he walked out of the bar with me and got in the cruiser. And I took him home.
Do you remember what you talked about on the ride to his house?
You know, I had an interest in logging too. And on the ride home, we talked about working in the woods and what the current wood prices were and pulp prices and firewood prices and, you know, what kind of chainsaws he liked. And, you know, we got back to his place and it was fine. You know, he sobered up the next morning, went and got his truck. Everything was fine. He died a few years ago, but it was only about a month or so before he died. He actually pulled up in front of my house one day, and I have a little sawmill, and he was interested in having some red cedar logs that I had sawed up. He's going to make like a picnic bench or something like that. And I actually sawed all the boards up for him. He died in the meantime, but I ended up giving it to one of his sons. I know a couple of his sons.
That was J.P. Sinclair. Tune in next Sunday for Rumblestrip to hear part two of that conversation. I want to thank Mark Davis for his excellent edits on this show. And the music for this show is by my friend and musician, Brian Clark. Rumblestrip is a podcast distributed on the radio by Vermont Public. This is Erica Heilman. Thanks a lot for listening.